This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
My name is Alex Tai Linval. I'm a current research assistant professor here at Texas Tech University Vietnam Center and Archive.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over.
Thank you for coming on the podcast. We've met last year at a wonderful academic conference in Eugene, Oregon. And I was just up there over the weekend and thought about you and, you know, our conversation today.
Yeah, it was a pleasure, you know, meeting you and so many other folks, right? Over about 100 folks from different generation, right? Those of the older generation in the community who led the community for many years, as well as the very younger generations of our age, and then of the even younger folks, right? Who are, you know, currently in their 20s, who are making efforts to really build the community here in America.
And yeah.
It's just a very, very great experience that I had too.
You talked a lot about things that came from your research, and you know, you and I have hung out here in California, and I'm curious to know, you know, your title as a research or a research assistant, and how do you get into this work? How did you evolve into a world of, you know, you're just, you know, floating out there researching?
Do you have time for
we have time. This is what this is for.
Well, thank you for the, again, Kenneth, thank you for the platform. It's just like many other people's journey. It's a long journey. And I've shared this story through different platforms before, either in Vietnamese or in English. But my journey to become kind of like a historian of Vietnamese history, of modern Vietnamese history, and to be in the position that I am now working at a research institution at a university has to do a lot with my personal upbringing. I was born in Vietnam in the province of Quảng Ngãi, which is most famously known for the province where the My Lai massacre occurred, which is approximately 10 kilometers away from my family home, during the time in which my father was also an officer in that region. But I was born after the war, so I had no idea, I had no understanding of the war in Vietnam, simply because in Vietnam, they don't really, at that particular time, I didn't really had a chance to be educated because of our family's background. My father was put in re-education camps for about 6 or 7 years. And after that, he came back, and that's when I was born. So I was born in the early 1980s. But because of the new economic policies, new economic zone, life was very tough. So my family moved around a lot. Right. And so I didn't really get a chance to be educated. But I remember when I was like playing around in my home village, and, you know, like as a kid in Vietnam, you don't really have a lot of toys. We play with mud. We play with clay to make cars, and we climb trees. Right. And I remember this one time I was climbing the star fruit tree at my neighbor's house, and she jokingly called, you know, pointed at me and said, "Conway, Sundi, right, or puppet child, you know, get down," you know, in a teasing way. She's a good family friend, right, good neighbor. But she said that, and at the time I was probably 5 or 6, had no understanding what that means, right? It's like someone putting a label on you for the first time, yet you don't know what it means. And you kind of felt that something was wrong. So I rushed home that afternoon, I remember, and kind of asked my father, what does we means, right? And I remember my father didn't say anything, and he just leaned over to me and said, shh, don't ever mention that
Wow.
word again, right? Because he is identified as we, right? But I didn't know that, right? And it's a negative connotation for being identified as that. For those who don't understand, it's very similar to, let's say, the Jewish people during
Holocaust.
the time of the Nazi and the Holocaust. They were branded with the Jewish star, for example, right? And I didn't know anything about those stuff, and of course I didn't ask any further, right? Until we came to America in 1990 via the what do you call that? The HO program that allows people who has family members who were imprisoned for 3 years and above to come to America. So my father, of course, at the time was in prison for more than 3 years, was allowed to come to America along with his family. So when we came to America, I still didn't know much. I started kind of, I think, first grade, and began to learn Vietnamese English, and had a hard time for the first like 3 or 4 years, really trying to grasp the language, the culture, the politics, and just trying to be successful in class and not to be teased, right? I remember having kids coming up to my, because my name in Vietnamese is Thai, and kids coming up to me, untying their shoes and put it in front of my face and say, tie my shoes. Or other kids, you know, remember in the 1990s, you have those Tai Bo exercise program,
Yeah.
and they said, like, do some Tai Bo, right? I didn't know any of these stuff, but I was very, you know, sometimes you feel offended. Sometimes you know, as I was playing up in the monkey bar and get called monkey, for example, right? And every Asian in that community was assumed as being Chinese, right? And I didn't know much about history until I think around 7th grade or 8th grade. In the history class, we started learning about the Vietnam War. Right. And then I think the teacher showed the movie, the documentary, the Vietnam War or something like that, produced in the 1980s. And then after that, we had some discussion. And one of my fellow students kind of asked me this question, like, which side of the family, you know, was your family on? And I didn't know what does he mean by side. But I could remember that my family at home, you know, whenever we have conversation about history, you know, usually at dinner, my father would say that our family is from the South, Mingnam, right? So I said, South, right? And then he pointed at my face, kind of laughing, and said, ha, that's why your family deserved to lose. And that hits me really hard, because I was like, what does it mean that my family deserved to lose? Because I still couldn't figure out winning and losing about, you know, war is very complex for a 7th grader, right? And for him to say that, to accuse that it's something that we deserve to, the word deserve, losing is not something I worry too much, but the word deserve, as though it's innate, that I was born into, that I deserve it, that something was wrong, right? And that bothers me the whole time growing up, right? But I didn't go into history, you know, I major in political science with the desire of wanting to be kind of like a lawyer, and was having the aspiration of wanting to be a social activist like Martin Luther King, my idol, right? But when I was at Berkeley, attending, doing my bachelor's at Berkeley, I decided to take this one course called Peace and Conflict. It was taught by a former Navy SEAL or Green Beret, I forgot who, at the time of the war, who dropped out of the service to protest against the war. So the way in which he presented the class was very anti-war. That is anti-American policy, thus anti-Vietnam Republic of Vietnam, right? In the way in which he portrays, to a class of 300 students with about 5 to 10 TAs. And I remember one of the TA was Vietnamese. And I remember after this one class lecture, the way in which he presented the class, the TA leaned over to her co-TA and said, "Now I understand why my parents and grandparents deserve what they deserve." Right? And I heard that word deserve again. She was sitting right in front of me, right? That reignited everything that went back to 7th grade. And so during the midterm, I decided to, instead of writing the midterm essay, you know, in college, you only have two essays really, midterm or the final, right? And I remember the midterm, instead of like answering the prompt that the professor asked us to answer, I decided to write a paper in which I asked the professor to use the second half of the course to present a more neutral stand in terms of how we can understand Vietnamese history or the war and whatnot. And I the reason why I did that was because I thought, you know, we're in America, right? We have this, we should have this discourse. We're at a very liberal university that is Berkeley, right? So I wrote this paper, and then I knew that, you know, it was not going to turn out well for me, but I got back a grade of F minus, with a full page of explanation saying that the reason why I deserved that grade was because I was such a bad writer and that I didn't write according to the prompt as asked. And then it's follow up with the reason saying that the reason why I wrote the paper in such a manner was because I was still bitter because of what happened. And I was still bitter over the fact that I couldn't overcome what happened to my family. And thus, but not. So that was
Wait,
the
wait, wait.
result.
Now I'm going to have to jump in with the questions because there's a lot of questions. This was that SEAL team professor that gave you the F minus. And do you think he read it and graded it?
I don't know. I don't know. It's either him or it's his students. But my guess later, you know, of course, I had, you know, as a graduate student, I also grade, you know, became, you know, teacher's assistant and grade papers for students. And whenever you have such a grade, whenever you give such a grade, you often have to talk to the professor so that you can reach an agreement. You don't just give out an F or an F minus, such a low grade, from the standpoint of an assistant. Maybe you can, maybe you're not. But for me, that reflects two things. If it's given by him, then it reflects who him as a person. But if it's given by a student, a teacher's aide, then it reflects somewhat his influence over them and themselves.
You know, I think today, wouldn't the proper approach be to not give the grade and call the student in and say, hey, let's have a discussion about this. I want to give you a shot to voice what you are talking about in your paper, and maybe we can figure out the finer points on the assignment, the prompt, instead of giving an F minus. And, you know, because I think today we are much more open as a society and in academics. I just can't imagine today a professor giving an F minus to a student because they disagree with the prompt or the fact that you probably didn't understand the assignment, right? What if you did understand the assignment and he just completely disagreed with your viewpoint and gave you an F minus? You know, none of it makes sense to me in today's context, but I'm curious to hear how it all ended.
Well, it's not that I didn't understand the prompt. I decided to write against the prompt. So I decided to not address the prompt and write an essay that
Yeah.
asked for something else. And so with that decision, I I knew that I was going to get a low grade. So I wasn't expecting a high grade or anything, but an F minus is as opposed to having a conversation. And the reason why I was writing, I chose to write in such a way, it was because I had anxiety problems when I was young, even to a few years ago, that I had to still learn how to overcome. And so as a result of that, I often don't really participate in class in verbally, right? So even if I have things to say, I would rather write it down and ask my friend to help me say it, because I had anxiety problems stemming from the fact that when I came to America as an 8-year-old or 9-year-old, starting first grade, having the struggle with English, and every word that you put out of your mouth, you get laughed at or teased. And then you, what happens? You seclude yourself. You and from first grade all the way up to college, even to grad school, I would not speak unless called upon. And every time I'm called upon, I would struggle. And so I used writing as a way to communicate, hoping that there would be a dialogue between myself and that professor at that time, similar to you, what you said, because that would be my approach now. If I have a student who disagreed with me in such point like that, then I would schedule a meeting with that student to have an understanding. But instead of having an understanding, I get the gray, and then I decided not to do anything about it, just keep it.
I mean, all of this makes sense now. I remember being at that academic conference in Eugene with you, and I actually asked you to come on the podcast at the time. I don't think you remember, but you kind of brushed me off, and I didn't take it personally, but I was like, that's weird. Like you spoke so well and you spoke so much at the conference. Why would you not want to come on the podcast? But now I kind of understand this sort of anxiety that you experienced earlier in your, and I bring this up because it was a question in my mind, like, why would you not want to talk about the research and the work that you do, right? And I was thinking in my head, maybe you don't remember the time that I did ask you to come on the podcast, and it was just sort of like there was no enthusiasm or, and then I asked you to come back on just recently when you asked me to get some help with the VHM, Vietnamese Heritage Museum, and you're like, oh really, you want me to want me on? And I'm wondering how you got through your anxiety of speaking or of speaking your mind. How did you get through, how did you break through all of this?
Yeah, no, great question. And this is, goes back to the first question that you asked, the journey of becoming a scholar of Vietnamese history, right? And with that being, you have to do a lot of public speaking, you have to teach, you have to be in front of a few people to even hundreds of people, right? And how did I overcome that? I actually didn't overcome that until very recently, until I was in graduate school. I remember when I was in college, my professor would write to me and said, "Alex, from what you're writing, from what you're articulating in your writing, you have so much to share. But you need to share it, because if you're not sharing it, nobody in class would understand, would know that you're thinking, right?" But I confined myself from not doing that since grade school all the way up. Anytime, like I said, anytime I had something I wanted to do, wanted to say, I would write it, pass it along to a fellow student to help me ask the question. And so when I came back to do my PhD at Cornell University, after a few years of finishing my master and went off to work, and I came back for my PhD thinking that I would make a smooth transition, right? And I remember with the, doing the PhD, you have to learn language. Language meaning you go to class every day, 5 days a week. You have to speak in class because that's learning language, right? And every time it's my turn to speak, some of my colleague who are now professors who were in those classes with me know exactly. Every time I'm called upon, I'll freeze. I would just forget everything, right? And it's not just language. In other classes, grad school is mostly about reading, research and discussion. You go into a class, you sit there for 3 hours where you have heated discussion over certain topics, and that's how you present yourself. That's how you present your ways, your interpretations of scholarship. That's how you show yourself. And that's how you get your grade. And in grad school, you have to maintain an A level grade in order to have this, continue to have the sponsorship to be in grad school. And I struggled with all those stuff in my first year. You know, I didn't know what to do. I came home kind of struggle with it because I didn't know how to share it with my wife. And then we had just gotten married. So I didn't want to put her down by sharing my most kind of, what do you call that? Weakness.
Yeah, in most feelings.
Right. And I remember my language teachers would come to me and give me those stress balls, trying to find ways to help me. And then eventually recommended that I should go see the psychiatrist. School psychiatrist. And I went and saw the psychiatrist who then prescribed some medication for me. Told me to, but then I came home, I looked at the bottle of medication, and then I come to realize that the psychiatrist didn't really understand, you know, the cause and effect of what's led to my anxiety and problems with speaking. In class and whatnot. And it all happens early, right? And how that carries
Yeah,
over. And that's
trauma.
why I could, yeah, and that's why I continue to tell people today that childhood trauma can last very
Yeah,
long to
lifetime.
adulthood, no matter who you are, right? Whether you're a president, whether you're a professor, whether you're a researcher or whatnot, it attacks us in different ways. And so I look at the bottle and I said, like, if I take this, meaning what I'm going to, you know, I'm going to put myself in a position where I'm going to be relying on this for much of my life, when in fact, maybe the person doesn't really understand me clearly,
Yeah.
right? It's not her fault. It's hard to share everything in a session and whatnot. So I threw the bottle of pills into the trash bin, never told my wife, never told anybody. I actually didn't tell my wife about this until just last year. And then I told myself, in order to overcome your fear, you have to put yourself against fear and overcome it. So my fear was to speak in front of people, right? Then I have to put myself in a position where I need to speak in front of people.
Yeah.
So during those years, I kept on signing myself up to various conferences, allowing myself to appear in different venues to speak, right? And at the beginning, it's always about, you know, writing a good script, standing there and reading word by words,
Yeah.
not looking at the audience because you are so fearful, sweat would come down. And every time you try to speak in front of people, memories from first grade, second grade, fourth grade comes back. And that's when you forget everything.
Yeah.
You forget even how to read the words in front of you. That is the reality that not just myself, I know that a lot of people goes through. But then I come to realize that after my first year, I published my first article on the Vietnamese land reform, right? Because prior to that, I felt judged. I felt like I didn't belong because I was struggling, right? I remember one of my professor, I was struggling so bad that one of the professor called me in and kind of like trying to help me, but also subtly say that, Alex, do you think this is the right career for you? Right? Meaning what? I don't think you fit, right? And so I came home. I didn't want to share this with my wife because we had just moved. We had just started a family. And if I quit, then what? Right? Of course, I could, you know, but it would take a long transition to something new. So I remember that. And so I of course, because I decided to go all through this whole motion, and I turned that first paper in that very class into my first published paper on the land reform. And I realized that after I published that paper, that that I garnered some appreciation, some respect from within the field. And that is when I felt like the sense of self-worth, that you're worth something, that you have something to contribute, similar to what many professors and teachers have told me before, but that was never really kind of like shown. And so that was when I realized that effort, I might have an accent when I speak in front of people. I might have some fear. I might have some nervousness, but I also have something to share. And it's important for me to reach for, to overcome that and share. And that's what enabled me to be the way I am today, to be able to sit in front of you, in front of a screen, and accept your call to come up and have these conversation with you today.
This episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. I love cooking with Red Boat because it's made with only two ingredients: wild-caught anchovies and sea salt. This premium fish sauce is made in Phu Quoc, Vietnam, and bottled right here in California. You can find Red Boat at select Asian supermarkets like 99 Ranch, H Mart, and Tong Phat.
Yeah, I appreciate that, and I didn't understand what the anxiety was all this time. And even when we before we started this call, I was like, you were kind of voicing a concern about me maybe provocatively provoking, the conversation. But I'm like, this is just a conversation. I want to hear about the land reform, and I want to hear about your journey, and I want to hear about the experience you've had in the archives in Vietnam. And all of these things are so interesting to me. I'm like, we're just here to have a conversation. I'm not here to provoke anything or take a position on anything. I'm like, I'm just a curious human being who wants to get to the bottom of all these things that have happened in the history of the Vietnamese people. I'm not here to attack anybody, right?
I know.
So I was like, wow, what is this all this anxiety from? But now I get it, and I appreciate you being open about it. I mean, we are almost 20 minutes into this conversation, and we spent a lot of time hearing about your journey, because that's important to me. Because many times we, as fully formed humans in our 40s and 50s, perhaps in our 60s, are not understanding why we are the way we are sometimes, because of the things that happened when we first arrived in Vietnam, or arrived in the US, or we're growing up, kids that are born here growing up and being teased for a certain thing that they have nothing to do with. And now you've sort of illuminated that. And so I appreciate you being very open with that process and that journey. Now I do want to get into, since you talked about that 1954 land reform piece, I want to hear, we're going to use this as a sort of case study in our conversation. How do you pick a topic like that? And in terms of positioning your, I mean, you got to take a side in terms of, historically, where do you land, and how do you, I'm not saying that criticizing a government or taking a perspective, but how do you pick a subject, and then how do you sort of find yourself planting a proverbial flag on a topic to move in a direction to provide some sort of context for the reader that's reading it?
Yeah, great question. And all, like I said, all these link back to what happens that I share at the beginning of the story is it becomes like the destiny to find out who I am. Why I'm being called puppet child, why I'm being perceived as deserving of losing the war, right? When I had nothing
Nothing to do with it.
to do with it, right? And so also at Berkeley was when I started to take classes on Vietnamese literature, Vietnamese history, Vietnamese culture, Vietnam War, and whatnot. But as a result of that class that I got an F minus, that I decided instead of going into law, I decided that I'm going to go into history and learn more about it's more for me a personal journey to learn more about my history, my own history, to write my own history from my own understanding of it through the rigorous work of researching, right? And that was when I decided to Let's start with some foundational events in modern Vietnamese history to have an understanding of the war that led to my coming to America. And so initially, I was interested not in the land reform, but I was interested in the Nhân Văn Giải Phóng affair, which you can see behind me are some of the publication associated with
Wait,
the affair.
can we break that down? Nhân dân giải phẩm, what does that mean?
Nhân Văn
Nhân
Giải Phóng
văn giải
affair.
phẩm.
So
Okay.
it was an affair in the late 1950s, 1956 specifically in northern Vietnam, when a groups of intellectuals who rose up, and these intellectuals were significant contributors to the war against the French, right? They followed the Viet Minh to fight against the French, as with many Vietnamese across the country at that particular time. And so they felt that during the war against the French, they had to subdue their talent and the way in which they expressed their creativity, their art, in order to make contributions to the war by writing propagandas, poems, songs, stories, or arts, creating propaganda arts in order to fight against the French. And they felt that by 1954, when the war had ended, that 1954, 55, 56, that they should have more freedom, the freedom to express themselves, the freedom to express love through poetries that not talks about sacrificing war, but poetries about poem, about flowers, about love, about beauty. And they felt like they couldn't do that. So they stood up and basically demanded for more freedom of expressions, more freedom of human rights, democracy, right? And so they came up with these two journals called Nhân Văn and Giải Phóng at the beginning of 1956, started with Giải Phóng, Mùa Xuân, in 1956, in February of 1956. And then that continues all the way to the end of 1956, around November and December of 1956, when the Vietnamese government under Ho Chi Minh put a clamp on it and a hammer on it and on the movement and said, "You can't do this anymore," and put many of the leading figures in the movement into prison camps, some for 15 years. Famous ones included Thủy Quê, a woman who actually poked her eyes out when she was imprisoned. Peter Zimmermann wrote a whole article on this. Many of them were sent to hard labor camp, and afterward would be ostracized from society. Some of the most known intellectuals, like Nguyễn Văn Tường, the most famous, arguably the most famous lawyer at the time, graduated from France. The philosopher Trần Đức Thảo, considered Vietnam's greatest philosopher at the time, were all put into this position. And it was the movement that I wanted to do my dissertation on. And it's these publications that I'm talking about that demanded for freedom, for democracy, for human rights, for the freedom to express themselves, right? But when I decided to study that, I realized that there was a cause for that movement, right? And a cause for the Vietnam War. So what was that? Of course, many, but I decided, let's go for back a little bit back further and explore what the event of the land reform in the 1950s, and how land reform was carried out. What was land reform? You know, the reason why that word came up to me was because when growing up as a child, you always remember that your parents and parents' generations always talk about cải cách ruộng đất. They always mention that word. Oh, cộng sản cải cách ruộng đất rất là tệ hại, rất là ác độc. But you don't really understand it, right? And as historians, you don't just stop there, right? You want to search out what went wrong, what happened, right? So I decided to start with land reform as the way to kind of understand the rise of communist movement in Vietnam.
Okay, I want to stop there. I want to ask you about this. Now, I always wondered when we think about land reform, and as a dummy, as a layman, when I think about land reform, I go two ways in my head. I go, there are some corrupt people at the top who just want to take land and they just want to hold on to it for their own use and their own greedy, you know, they just want to take it and have it. Or they're truly believing and buying into the communist propaganda at the time and saying everybody should be even, everybody should be equal, we should just redistribute this land for the proper good use of society. What in your research do you think is the sort of, I know it can't be black and white, but does it lean more on like these greedy people who just want to take land, or does it lean more on, you know, these people who had ideals and idealistic about sort of this sort of utopian society where everybody's equal and there's no land ownership?
I think it's more of the latter. So when the Vietnamese communist government carry out land reform, beginning as early as in the 1940s, after they established themselves as the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, which later is known as North Vietnam, when they were fighting the war against the French. And so in order to kind of like answer that question that you just posed, but also to understand why land reform happens in Vietnam, you have to contextualize it within the context of the First Indochina War. That is the war against the French, right? Land was very important, especially in the north, because northern Vietnam didn't really have much land, farmland, right? And it was assumed that most of the land were in the hands of the landowners and the rich peasant. And so to answer your questions, was this motivated by just the government wanting to gather all the land to themselves? Not necessarily, right? But were they inspired by communist ideologies in terms of, you know, taking lands and dividing it and giving it to the people so that they're creating an egalitarian utopia? I think they were very much motivated by that, but they didn't know how, right? And to in terms of putting in into practice, right? And so what happened was that in all the way up until 1949, 1950, they talk about land reform since the establishment of the Communist Party, but they didn't know how to carry it out, right? Because carrying it out has to have a model, right? And at that particular time, they were still in the 1930s and 40s, the Communist Party was still a weak party, right? It's not strong. By the 1940s, 50s, they were still fighting a war against the French and didn't really know how to carry out land reform. It wasn't until 1949, late 1949 and early 1950 with Mao Zedong and the Chinese Communist Party winning over in mainland China that Mao Zedong became the successful model for how to start a revolution and succeed in a revolution. And thus Ho Chi Minh and the Vietnamese Communist Party looked toward Mao as the model for which to carry out a war against an opposition, that is the French or the in China, the Kuomintang, and also look at Mao in terms of implementing social economic policies, right? So immediately after the establishment of the CCP in mainland China, in terms of its control over mainland China, Ho Chi Minh sent representative over to China and the Soviet Union asking for recognitions of his state. And through that, China sent over Chinese advisor under Ho Chi Minh's request to teach Vietnamese how to carry out land reform, as well as to aid Võ Nguyên Giáp and others in terms of fighting the war strategically, right? With generals sent from China. So the person that Mao Zedong sent over to Vietnam, the leader of that team was a guy named Lo Quy Bo or La Quy Ba, right? He later became the first ambassador to Vietnam, to North Vietnam. And then of course later teams of Chinese land reform understand that China in 1950 to 1952 was also carrying out land reform themselves. So by 1952, they already have this experience. And of course, also in the 1930s, they had already carry out land reforms in parts where they have control over.
Right.
So they have this experience that by 1952, they came to Vietnam. Lo Quy Bo in late 1952 wrote a draft, sent it to Ho Chi Minh and Trường Chinh, leaders of the party, saying, this is how you should carry out land reform. And the reason why you need to carry in land reform is because you need to mobilize the mass, the majority of the population at the time. About North Vietnam around that time has a population of about 12 million. 10 millions were peasants, right? And so the argument was that in order to win the war against the French, you need to be able to mobilize this, the mass, in order for them to join in the fight, right? To give them something. But also, you need to have control over the resources, that is food supply, that is rice, that is crops, right? And how do you do that? Well, you have to be able to take over land, right? But also, strategically, you don't win war just by fighting and taking over a place militarily. You win war by taking over a place military and have your own people to have control, to take control of that region long term in order to win land, right? That's how war was fought. For many years, they didn't do that. They didn't know how to do that. But land reform was argued that land reform would allow them to do that because it would tell the peasant that, hey, if you fight with us, then we'll give you the land from the rich, the evil landowners who have exploited you for all these time. We'll take their land, we'll give it to you. You come and join us in fighting against the French, but also we can give you the land that you need in
Makes
order to
sense.
farm, right? And so that then would what does that do? Through land reform, it allows the party to categorize their enemies as enemies of the party state, as traitors, as people who sided with the French, as people who exploited the peasant, right? So it's called đấu tố, denunciation, right? They would target certain groups of people in, let's say, a village. So they would have a quota that every commune or xã in Vietnam at that particular time should have about 5% landowners, right? So example, if you have 1,000, then you should have, let's say, one person as a landowner. So the party state, that is Ho Chi Minh's party and government, would send a team of cadres down. It's called đội cải cách chủ đất. They would go into a team and follow these teams, these especially these initial teams, or Chinese advisor, teaching them how to carry out every steps. And they would go into a team where they would break down into teams of three, teams of four, five, and would go into smaller hamlets and villages. And then would seek out the poorest, the most poorest people in the village, and then would infiltrate into those family by carrying out what is known as three others. Ba cùng, three togethers. What does that mean? They would request the family to live together with the family, the cadres would, to eat together with the family, meaning to share their food, and to work together, meaning to work together with the family. And through that, they come to indoctrinate the poor peasant to see that, oh, the reason why you are in this economic state was not because of heaven's making, not it's not because of natural cause, but because of the exploitation of the rich class. So creating a class tension, that is class struggles between two sides in terms of how they see each other. And then continue through those people, recruit more people of likings to join together. And then
See,
after.
Alex, this whole origin story of land reform and the ideals of taking over land that belonged to rich French dominated, these come from good ideals, right? And you're indoctrinating and you are, trying to help the peasants from, as a communist at the time. That early origin story, I think we as Americans or Vietnamese Americans, we can identify with that struggle. And today we see such disparity between the rich and the poor in America, and we see it in Vietnam. And the same things are happening. But an hour and a half with you is not enough time because I can literally go on for like another 5 hours to talk about from that point to where, you know, they're just doing so much destruction to the country and things veer off course. And, you know, that requires us to have like many, many hours of breaking down how the system gets all haywire, you know, because it seems like what you just told me comes from a place of, you know, raising up the life of these poor people and taking money away from the rich French who are invaders into the country. But then where does it, you know, it all goes sour somehow in the next 50 to something years, and it just gets really dark and harrowing. But, you know, there's a progression that, you know, it takes so long for us to get into. Meanwhile, we need to talk about the Vietnamese Heritage Museum. So we need to find a way to wrap this up in a neat bundle somehow. Cause, you know, I have like 20 questions for you. I haven't even gotten to one question yet. And this stuff is very, very interesting. But it's a starting point for our conversation and future conversations between you and me, you know, cause I want to, you know, keep bringing you on to kind of dig into not just the land reform, but like the archival stuff and Vietnam opening up and the development of where we are economically. These are all things that I can nerd out about with you. So let's figure out a way to transition from this into the Vietnamese Heritage Museum.
Definitely. You know, if you are, you know, if you ever welcome me back, we have many.
I mean, we're like almost an hour in and we're like, we can just keep going on this land reform stuff. And I'm like, well, we have all these other topics that we need to talk about, but how do we wrap this? Yeah.
Well, definitely. Just to wrap this up, but also to explain how the land reform becomes considered one of the most bloody episodes in modern Vietnamese history, if not the most bloody aside from the war, was because it's not just about later, the movement was not just about taking land from rich French owner.
Right.
Taking land from nationalists, those who actually supported the revolution against the French. Most notably is a woman named Nguyen Thi Nam, who hosted Ho Chi Minh and his comrades and who protected her. Her two sons were in the army fighting against the French, yet she was the first one to be executed as a woman. So that led to the escalations of violence, especially in the context of a Vietnam that is divided, and you have a competition between North Vietnam and South Vietnam. So land reform became a mechanism in order to consolidate power, and as a result of that, it becomes the violence and the indiscriminate persecutions and denunciations of people become overwhelming by 1954, 55, 56, right? And that led to the party later in 1957 or 1956 coming out and apologizing. The first time the Vietnamese Communist Party ever come out and apologize for something. And thus, to this very day, is still a topic that in Vietnam they don't want to talk about.
Yeah.
In 2014, they opened, I think 14 or 13, they, as the 60th anniversary of the land reform, they organize an exhibit at the National Museum. After 5 days, they had to shut it down because of so many alternative voices.
Wow.
Voice. And so they had to shut it down, citing electrical
reasons. But the fact that they even had an exhibit to sort of be apologetic about that land reform and having all these alternative voices come out to speak up against it is sort of, I don't know, courageous on the government's part.
No, actually, that was not their intention.
It's miscalculated.
Their intention was that they felt that after 60 years, people might have forgotten about it and that they can reshape the narrative. And so what happens is, like, they put on display a very positive narrative about the land reform. It's all about accusing the landowners of doing all the bad stuff, and that they deserve what. And that was what caused the uproar among people. Right? Understanding this, the land. That's why you understand that land reform was not so much about taking land and dividing it out to people. Because 2 years after land reform, the government took all the land back under what is known as collectivization. So they collect all the land back and thus made people work under those collectives. So the land reform was not meant to divide land for the people and give it to the people, but to give the party state the full control over production and people. Once you control people and production, then you are able to control the movement of people and that it helps explain the next war. Why you understand, let's say for the next war and the second war before we move on, is remember the Tet Offensive. Let's say North Vietnam sent down 80,000 folks, 40,000 died, right? 3 years later in 1972, 4 years later in 1972, they sent down 300,000. What enabled them to do that? It's the land reform. Because it allows, through the land reform, it allows them, the party state, to situate their people in all these areas to command people to go to war, to produce for the war, right? To continue to send men down to the war. That's why to this very day, in my position as a researcher, I'm reading so many letters by communist soldiers who went south when they write back, and these letters never got back to their family because they were killed. Right. So in these letters, you have letters where the soldier would write to his father and his parents saying, "Ba mẹ, nhà nước có con đã đi 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 lính rồi, nhà nước có cho ba mẹ cái số đất mà họ promise ba mẹ hay không?" The reason why he went to war was because he was promised that if he goes to war, his parents are going to be given such land in order to farm. Right? And that's why that helps to understand the massive people that were mobilized to fight the next war. That is the second war, right? So that's why to wrap land reform up in a sense, we can understand, we in order to understand any historical event, we need to kind of always contextualize it within the larger historical movement. And so all these kind of like research about modern Vietnamese history comes. Helped me to come to realize that, especially as a Vietnamese American now, that it's important for my generations and the next generation, even for my parents' generations, whose history has been taken away from them, right? Understand that in Vietnam, the history of the Republic of Vietnam are not being taught. The history of people like my father are being called traitors and puppet, right? They're not being called legitimately as officials of the Republic of Vietnam. Right. And so their history was taken away from them. And in America, it's the same way. If you read American history in high school or in colleges, often is portrayed from the perspective of Americans. So really, people of my parents' generations, of our parents' generations, don't have a voice. And reality is that us, ourselves, of our generations, we don't really have a voice in terms of how our history should be lived, right? And thus, the next generation, that is the generations of my daughter, my son, right? If myself as a historian, as a person, as a Vietnamese Americans, are not going to do anything about this to try to preserve this history, this complex history, then how am I going to expect the next generation going to have a sense of understanding of the past? And what I mean by understanding the past is not to understand the divide between people, the hate between people, but to understand what led to their presence here in the moment that they are in, calling themselves as not American, but Vietnamese American.
This episode is brought to you by Songkhai Distillery, my only go-to gin company. Established in 2018, Songkhai Distillery is Vietnam's first gin distillery, founded by Daniel Nguyen, a Vietnamese American from Southern California. No matter how many people I have at my parties, we are always pouring Songkhai Gin. Songkhai Gin is handcrafted in small batches and prioritizes using botanicals and ingredients that are native and heirloom to Vietnam. The result is a product uniquely Vietnamese in taste and aroma. Songkhai is now growing to include rice wine and traditional Vietnamese herbal liqueurs similar to Amaro. Songkhai prides itself in Vietnam, from the farmers who grow the fruits and herbs to the artists behind the artwork and design. Songkhai is a community effort of people who are proud to be Vietnamese and collectively embody the spirit of Vietnam.
to well, see
let me make an argument for this. And obviously I side with you and why this stuff is so important, because obviously if I don't agree with you, I wouldn't be sitting here with you and many people like you to talk about why we're always talking about this, you know, admittedly sometimes to the younger, much younger generation could be very boring, esoteric. However, I do have a question. As we go on for the next 50 years of our history, Vietnamese American history in the US, how is this idea of history being important to people like you and me? Because we've lived most of our lives with under the shadows of this, our parents' generation going through that, those hardships and that historic trauma that they went through, and now it's bled into us. But when we think about our kids, you and me, you know, 5 or 6, 10 years old kids, and they're going to live as these sort of worry-free Americans that have some Vietnamese roots, you know, some connection to Vietnam. Why do we care so much about what they understand about our parents' past? Land reforms in 1954. Why do we care so much? Why should we care so much about the Vietnamese Heritage Museum? I want to hear it from you. Obviously, I have my reasons and they probably align with your reasons, but I want to hear it from a historian's viewpoint. Why this stuff is so going to be important to our children's and their children's lives?
I think the one word to explain it is clarity, right? At least for me. So I can't speak for you or anybody else, but I'm speaking for myself. Let's say clarity of your identity, of who you are, of why you are present in the moment that you are, why I'm being called Vietnamese Americans or Asian Americans and not strictly American. Why of identity, why my name is Alex hyphen Thai Dinh Vo, not Thai Dinh Vo, or not just Alex, right? Every one of us is different. Obviously, you know, we have about 4 million Vietnamese American in America right now or abroad. Not everybody's going to reflect history and culture and heritage the same way. And that's not expected. Everybody should have their free choice in terms of how they interpret their history, their identity, and whatnot. My goal as a historian, as a historian, is to preserve history and to make it available so that whomever one day would ask for resource would have something available for them to search through. So I have a scholar who is very famous. His name is John Phan, who is at Columbia today. He went up to this Vietnamese study group email list yesterday and asked if anybody have any resources on the re-education camp experience, because he's teaching that. He's helped, right? He's a scholar of Vietnamese language. He doesn't know much in terms of that expertise, and he had to rely on people. And so when he asked that question, and if we don't have any books about it, if we don't have any resource about it, if we don't have any artifacts of that experience, then how is he going to teach the next generation that he's teaching about those events? So in the last 2 days, there's a bunch of people coming in and gave him lists of books, names of books that I, even though as a researcher of such topic, have not heard about.
Wow.
And so the task of preserving and of making these historical accounts, historical records, historical artifacts available for the next generation is important. Not important for everybody, right? But yeah, it's important for whomever is in need of it. My coming into this career started from a questioning of what is puppet, what is deserving of losing. So those are questions that doesn't have any, I didn't have any clarity over.
Yeah.
And so in order to do history is for me to seek out clarity, to answer those questions, to understand my belonging here in America. What led me to become a Vietnamese American? Thus have give me of a better understanding of my voice, my privileges, my power and what I can do, right? And thus, that's why I'm not just teaching. I'm not just doing research here. But I'm also doing now in the capacity that I am as a professor, as a researcher, is that I am working with different organizations, with even governments, the US government and the Vietnamese government, to build relationships, to mend relationships. So for example, I'm working with the Vietnamese Heritage Museum. As you know, the Vietnamese community in America, we have been here for almost 50 years. Next year, it's gonna be 50 years. Yet, we still don't really have museums that really have the capacity to host resources. So that then what happened is really it, to a certain extent, it weakens the positions of our community because we don't have a place to go to for resources to have an understanding of our past, our present, and maybe our future. So I'm collaborating with the Vietnamese Heritage Museum, which is currently locating in Orange County, a nonprofit, where its mission is to educate, to inform, and to share a heritage with the public by preserving as much as possible, right? And so with this museum, it's doing a lot of great projects, such as an oral history project, right? Where they're trying to interview as many survivors of the war as possible, because many of those folks are in their 70s, 80s, and 90s are going away. Keeping their memories for the next generation, for the John fans who are teaching at Columbia right now, right? To be able to use, to relate those information to their students in the future. They have projects such as the Boat People Commemoration Wall, Memorial Wall, which is like, as you know, you have a Vietnam War Veterans Memorial Wall in Washington, D.C. that commemorate the 48,000, the 58,000 American service member who passed away in who died in Vietnam. Yet you have an unimaginable number of Vietnamese who die at sea. Yet to this very day, we don't really have anything to commemorate them. So they are doing a virtual wall of commemorating these people and their names and whatnot. So with that project together, we decided to for this year's anniversary of the April 30th, 2024, and we hope to continue this project into the future, is that we are just basically asking people like yourself and others to send in photographs, collage, pictures, arts, or whatever that help you, that kind of like instill in you a sense of what it is that is 1975, April 30th, or the consequences of that. That is, let's say, re-education camp, post-war, or refugees, or being Vietnamese Americans. So by people submitting pictures, right, yourself submitting something, myself submitting something, and others submitting something, and we're going to put it in an exhibit, that then would allow people to come in and see diverse perspectives and reflection. And through those diverse perspective angles and pictures would reflect things differently and have a better, a more wholesome perspective on understanding this April 30th, 1975 event. And that's what we're trying to do with this, my partnership with the Vietnamese Heritage Museum.
So where can they send these pictures to?
I think for now is the best way that they could do it is they can send it to my email, kind of like a scan or a picture of it to my email. And then of course we can develop that out and then exhibit it. What I would ask them to do is that they can submit up to three pictures, right? Of any choices, right? Or painting or arts that they do, but submit it with their profiles, a name for each of the pictures, a title for each of the pictures, and then along with each pictures, write a 4 to 5 sentence descriptions of their feeling about that picture, right? For example, I have this picture of myself as an immigrant coming to America, holding this number in front of me when I was photographed. So with this, what emotions, when I look at this, what emotion comes out? I would like these contributors to write it in 4 or 5 sentences so that when the viewers, when the audience come in, they get to sense what the person who's submitting it is articulating. But through that, they can also have their own interpretations of someone else's experience of history.
And what's your email address?
Alex T. Vo at VietnameseMuseum.org. So Alex, then the letter T, and then Vo, VO at VietnameseMuseum.org. Or another email that they could send to me that's probably easier is Z San Chien Chan Vietnam, for those who speak English. It's just Z San Chien Chan Vietnam. So basically it's just you spell it out without the accent mark at gmail.com. Z San Chien Chan Vietnam at gmail.com, and just send it to me, or they can contact me at my phone, 757-318-1661. 757-318-1661. They can send me a text, and then through that I can help them through the whole process of how to do this. And I very much would like everybody around the world through your platform here to submit something so that we can share our journey, our experience with others, so that we can together learn our history.
Alex, thank you so much for today. We didn't get to 90% of the things that I prepared for us to talk about. However, I'm sure in the next few months and weeks, well, let's get back together and let's talk about, I want to nerd out on the research aspect of archives. And, recently I was at a party and somebody asked me about the archival side of the history work that that we do in our community. And I'm fascinated by the idea of Vietnam as a institution that controls their own archives. Why would they open it up to people who are descendants of Cong Nguyen, right? All of that stuff is very interesting to me, and we'll get to it in time. But today I think we introduced you and we talked about the VHM program, and we will get to the other aspects of your work in a future podcast.
Great. Thank you so much for the platform. Thank you so much for giving voice. And I would be happy to talk about the archive because it's important as a important topic to understand the politics behind it, but also the experience of doing archival work in order to write history, right?
Yeah,
To preserve history, right?
that deserves a whole hour and a half on its own. The whole process of that is, because information is controlled all over the world, not just in Vietnam, but in the US.
Exactly.
And, but when you get back into archival work and they're letting you in to kind of do research, there's all kinds of political strings that are attached and methods, and it's all interesting. It's very interesting to me to hear.
It's still very much control, but I think that the whole process, the maturation, the opening up of the archives, of course, in the 80s, you can't do this. In the 90s, it was very difficult. Even in the 2000s, when I started my research, it was challenging, but now it becomes easier. But when you talk about easier, let's say, for example, now they make it, they digitize most everything. And so for a lot of younger scholars who are new to the archive, they'll come in and say, "Oh, it's so easy, right? We can just turn on the computer and search everything." But then actually it's a form of control. Because now that they made it available on digitizing it, put it on the computer, it allows them to search for terms. So when I request for something, you request for something, they can search for specific terms that they don't want you to see, and then remove those pages out of what you can see. Whereas before, when they come out with a stack of 300 pages, they're not going to go through every single one,
Wow.
right? So we have to understand the politics of the
Yeah.
archives. In that way, hopefully we have a separate episode for
Yeah,
it.
we will. We'll definitely do it. All right. Well, Alex, thank you so much, and we'll talk very soon.
All right. Thank you, Kenneth. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.